on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Listening today to Purple Heart recipient Seth Irving of Rio Rancho, New Mexico, originally from Pine Ridge, South Dakota. He's proud of his Oglala Lakota heritage. And if you're a Buffalo Bill Cody buff, you've probably heard of Seth's grandfather, the horseman and interpreter Bronco Bill Irving. Seth was an all-state basketball player in high school who joined the Navy in September of 1942. And when we left off, he was an anti-aircraft gunner on the destroyer USS Newcomb. We're going to hear how that ship survived 5 kamikaze hits in a single day, and how Seth survived the one that blew him into the water with burns over most of his body. But I'm curious, had you ever even contemplated the possibility that a plane might deliberately crash into your ship or one of the others that you were trying to protect?
No, I didn't anyway. I thought they were just coming to shoot at us and go home, you know, sink us or do whatever they had to do.
Do you remember when you first heard that term, kamikaze, and understood what it meant?
Yeah, it was after we got out of Lady Gulf, and I don't know where they assigned us to, but we went steaming around places. There's another little island, and I forget where it was, and we were parked there getting refueled and food and stuff like that. And that night, we saw the first kamikaze, or heard of it, and it hit a couple ships, but there wasn't us. They didn't hit us. They hit a couple of ships that were anchored. And, of course, they gathered us all together. After that, we went to Iwo. That's when we ran into a lot of kamikaze planes that started to come.
I'm just curious, trying to get inside your head. And, again, I know it's a long time ago, but was that a game changer? Now to know that these planes weren't just going to bomb you or shoot at you, that they might try to deliberately crash into you or another ship?
Yeah, it made a lot of difference. I mean, you better shoot them down, you know, before. But they sure did hit a lot of ships.
So you get to Iwo Jima, and you guys were there quite a while before the Marines hit the shore, just shelling the heck out of that island.
Yes. We were maybe 3,000 yards off of the beach when they were landing, and we could see them land.
Being there as long as you were before the invasion and knowing how much firepower was devoted to that island from the air and from all your ships off the coast, were you surprised to see how strong the Japanese forces still were once the Marines hit the beach?
Yes, I was, because it was just a little old. I didn't see how people could live on that island, you know. Yeah, I was surprised because of the terrain of that. It just was nothing but black dust and stuff, you know.
Yeah, volcanic ash.
Yeah, and that Mount Suribachi, I don't think anybody could live on that thing.
But you guys didn't know they had all those tunnels and caves and that whole network in there.
No, we didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, everybody who was at Iwo Jima, I have to ask, did you see something flying on top of Mount Suribachi? Did you ever catch wind that something had been erected up there?
I was there to see it. You know, I could have.
Yeah.
But I missed it. Several days later, I saw it, though, you know. The next day, I thought. Several days later, I saw it, though, you know. The next day, I thought.
Right. Well, I didn't mean, did you see it go up, but you saw a flag flying on top of Mount Suribachi.
Oh, yeah.
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 You probably saw the second flag, which was a little bigger than the first flag, as the story goes.
Yeah.
And, of course, one of the flag raisers, famously, was a Native American, Ira Hayes, who I'm sure you've read a lot about. But just to see the Stars and Stripes, your flag, flying on top of that mountain, did it mean something to you?
Boy, howdy, that was a great, you know, we knew that they were cleaning them out by that time.
Obviously, the photo of the flag going up atop Mount Suribachi, one of the famous, most famous photos of all time, if not the most. Mm-hmm. When you see it, if you saw it right now, what do you think of when you look at that image? Does it mean something to you?
Yes, it does. It kind of makes me proud, really. But I had a cousin, first cousin. His name was Clement Crazy Thunder. He was a Marine.
Uh-huh.
And he was one of the very first to get killed on Iwo.
Clement Crazy Thunder.
Clement Crazy Thunder.
Was he from your same reservation?
Yes.
When did you find out that he was killed?
After the war. He went to that Catholic school I went to, too.
Right.
He was probably a year or two younger than me. They buried him on that cemetery there at Holy Rosary Mission.
So when you're there on the Newcomb, Mm-hmm. You're describing for us what you saw with the Japanese taking out Marines as they hit the beach.
Mm-hmm.
You might have seen your cousin get killed. He could have been one of those Marines.
Yeah, could have been. Could have been. But I didn't know it at the time.
And by the time you did find out, you had been through quite an ordeal yourself. But when you did hear that your cousin died there, that same battle that you were involved in, how did you take that? What did that do to you?
Of course, I didn't know it until way later, and so it didn't have that much of an impact on me because there was a lot of people from Pine Ridge killed in the war.
And it wasn't that big a place to begin with.
Yeah, but Pine Ridge wasn't that big a place.
Yeah. So the sacrifice made by that town and that reservation was disproportionate.
Oh, golly, a lot of them in the service, and a lot of them got killed in the service.
Mm-hmm. Well, you almost got killed in the service.
I almost did.
Really stinking close, and I want everybody to hear this story. So you get through Iwo Jima.
Yeah.
And then a month and a half later, you're at Okinawa.
Right.
And this is where the kamikazes went into a frenzy.
Well, they were coming directly from Japan, one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, they were coming off of aircraft carriers, which they didn't have anymore.
Yeah, they were out of them.
Yeah.
Thanks to the Navy.
They ran out of them. But at Okinawa, they were coming directly from the island of Japan. Now, we went to Okinawa about 3-4 days and bombarded, and then the Marines came and Army came and landed. Then we went on picket duty, they called. All the destroyers were lined up around, kind of half circle around the island, and we were on the northernmost part of that circle. April 6, 1945, approximately 4:35 o'clock, we got a report that over 500 kamikaze planes were leaving Japan.
And you still weren't scared?
No, we got prepared to fight.
Holy moly.
Yeah. And then, you know, we had a lot of aircraft carriers around. They released their, and they shot down approximately half of them. Or a little over a half.
Mm-hmm.
So there's only about 200 or something got through into the ship area. And that's when we got into it.
So you're on your 40-millimeter mount.
I was on my 40-millimeter mount, but I wasn't firing on anybody because my ship must have been going east. The planes came from the north.
Mm-hmm.
And so the port side man, he was firing on them. But we were at a standstill because there was nothing coming past.
So you're just sitting there waiting to get something to shoot at.
Sitting there on our train, waiting for somebody to tell us there's a plane here or there. But the first kamikaze that broke through, I had a rangefinder. He was on the phone with the control. We told him where the planes were. And he would set the range on that gun sight. And he's the one that told me, he said, hit the decks if there's the plane coming. So I don't know how I did it. I unhooked, and I didn't hit the deck. By that time, it blew me into the water.
You didn't hit the deck because the plane hit your ship before you had a chance to hit the deck.
Yes. All I could see was planes coming. That's all I remember anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I must have lost it, but I wound up in the water.
So the impact of this kamikaze on your ship blew you right into the water.
Yeah.
Means the ship hit, the plane hit pretty close to where you were.
Yeah, it hit about the middle of the stack. And the stack that I was on threw me and bent over. And I guess that's what happened to me. But that rangefinder didn't make it.
A lot of guys didn't make it.
Yeah. No, I had a 10-man gun crew. I was the only survivor on that gun crew. The other gun crew, there was only one survivor off of that one. I was firing at it. And then after I got into the water, the propeller must have missed me by 2-3 feet.
So you're in the water, you're conscious, you're burnt, well, and this propeller is flying right at you? The propeller from the plane, or you're talking about?
Look, our propeller.
Your
the ship.
You almost got caught in the screws of the destroyer.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I must have been underwater because I could hear it just mumble. And I came up, and that screw, you know, was pushing the water, and it just pushed me out of the way.
Wow.
Pushed me about 100 feet or more away from the ship.
I'm sure you're still pretty stunned and dazed, but how much pain were you in?
I don't remember being in any pain. All I know is that when I was strapped in, I had a steel helmet on. I had a capon jacket on, and all of my clothes were gone. I was bare.
You were naked in the water?
Yeah. I didn't have no shoes. I was burned from my hair was all burned off to about my knee, all on the front side, you know.
So the explosion blew all your clothes off, yeah. Your helmet off, yeah. Burnt all your hair off, yeah. And burnt you from head to knee.
Yeah.
But you weren't in pain.
I don't feel pain. I don't know why. I just didn't feel pain.
What went through your mind when you realized what kind of condition you were in?
Survival, I guess. That's when survival takes over. I was in that water from about 4:30 until about 10 o'clock at night. Now, that was the scariest part, because you start getting scared, you know.
Well, yeah.
Because of the sharks, etc. I was really scared. And during that period, from about 4:30, 5 o'clock, there was a burnt life raft came floating by, and I jumped onto it. I thought I was going to get saved, but there was nothing on there. It was just burnt. And I was riding it along like that in a ship, and in maybe 2-3 hours, and it was getting dark, and I saw a silhouette of a destroyer sitting there, and I noticed that I was going to miss it by floating, you know.
Yeah, you're floating on this raft, and, yeah. And it's going to take you away from the destroyer.
Yeah. So I abandoned the raft. I figured even though that ship probably couldn't pick me up because they're still under attack, you know.
Yeah, it's not like you can hit the timeout button, come pick me up. They're still fighting each other.
Yeah. And so I was just about ready to get to that ship, and it took off. Of course, on that water, it just pushed me back out of the way, and there I was. With nothing, just swimming by myself. I didn't have nothing on me.
So you're naked, you're burnt, you've already been in the water for 3 hours, and now your chance at survival just
vanished.
Went away from you.
Yeah.
Did you think you were going to die in that moment?
Yes, I did. I figured I don't think I could make it till morning.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you hear stories about ships and survivors on life rafts for 4 or 5 days, some weeks, some. But I didn't think I was going to make it. Then it was pitch dark. And then I was floating and floating, and it was dark. And all of a sudden, I saw a flicker of light. Just barely saw it. I started screaming, you know. That light came right up to me. And they picked me up around 10 o'clock at night. And, of course, they gave me morphine and put me out. Within a half an hour, within 15 minutes while I was aboard that ship. I got up by the ship, and they were going to, guys came down on a
rope ladder?
Yeah.
To get you?
To get me. And they grabbed my hand like that, and that slipped and fell back into the water.
Did they just pull the skin off your arms?
Yeah.
Oh, ouch.
I was burned, you know. I didn't realize it either.
They didn't realize it either?
No, they didn't know it. You know, the next group came down, they raised me up out of there.
That had to be painful. Were you still kind of numb or in shock? Huh?
I must have been in shock because I don't even remember pain. All I remember, I was saved. I know that within 15 minutes, I was treated, you know. Whatever they did was right.
You mentioned when you first found yourself in the water and took stock of the situation that you were concerned about sharks, about, you know, the enemy that was still firing away.
Yeah.
Did you see any sharks during those 6 hours?
Nope.
Good thing.
No. And another strange thing is I didn't see another body.
Nothing.
Nothing. I don't know if that propeller caught me alone and sent me out that way.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I looked and looked and looked because I was wanting to be picked up right away, you know.
I don't blame you.
Yeah. But I didn't see a soul. I was out there for them 6 hours alone.
6 hours?
Yeah.
How long did it feel like?
Lifetime, really. Oh, howdy.
I've talked to some guys who've been in similar situations in the water for a long time. And some guys will describe doing things to keep their mind occupied or thinking through different scenarios, or some guys would say a prayer. They'd frantically, you know, try to get someone else's attention. What did you do? How did you pass that time?
I don't remember.
I mean, mentally, what was going through your mind? Were you saying a prayer? Were you saying, I'm going to make it? I know I can? I mean, how did you keep going? Where did you find that hope and that persistence to power through?
All I know is I had to survive, you know.
Yeah.
And I did whatever I could.
Well, and it worked. You're here to tell that story 70 years later. I have some more questions about it, but it's time to take another break. If you want to see some photos of Seth and his remarkably resilient ship, visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. You'll see him with his wife of 68 years, Elfrida. We're going to find out how they met and even hear from her when Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch after this.